Welcome again to KBOO, Emmeline Friedman.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, you were on the Olmos several months ago to talk about the film The Social Dilemma and how this documentary attempts to explain the way users are enlisted to participate in platforms such as Facebook. Well, today we're talking about a much smaller platform, 8chan or 8kun more recently, and the image board where QAnon circulates as a thread, one that is feeding conspiracy theories advanced by many Trump supporters. QAnon has now entered the mainstream lifeblood of the Republican Party. Critiques of QAnon have also entered the mainstream with documentaries and HBO series and political commentary expressing urgency around QAnon as a lethal threat to American democracy and a recruitment site for far-right politics and violence. Emmeline, you've written about internet technologies and platforms, written a book about the internet and social media users, and worked in campaigns to reclaim the internet for public interest and as part of the commons. So let's talk about your assessment of the QAnon phenomenon, starting with how it works from a technological perspective.
Sure. So without diminishing the hard truths that QAnon distill for us politically, it is really important to see it as a web platform business at its finest, really. So most social media sites make their money by selling ads. And to sell ads, of course, you need users. To get users, you need amazing content that excites people and draws them in. And of course, people stay on these platforms, not just to observe passively, but to participate. So this is how the combined power-profit motive works. And this is why we shouldn't be surprised that Q is not, in fact, a high-level government official like Steve Bannon or Michael Flynn. Even if these guys eventually took advantage of what was going on there, Q turned out to be the father-son platform owner and technical administrator duo.
But by way of identifiers, why the Q and why the Anon? What do those terms mean?
Yeah, so Q refers to a high-level government clearance, a security clearance. And basically the idea is that this guy who goes by Q, but mostly remains anonymous, is dropping, he does Q drops, so he drops little bits and little leaks of information that is meant to be read, interpreted as signs to a whole bunch of users kind of participating in this mystery, basically.
Is it like create your own adventure for adults?
Very much so. And one of the most interesting parts, I think, of this participation strategy implemented by the owner and administrator of this for-profit platform is that they really invite users to do their research and kind of solicit them as intelligent, you know, intelligent interpreters and people who are really in the know and able to read these signs. And they say, hey, we need your minds on
this. So then that's that whole refrain, do the research, that plays on you can't trust scientists or the government or official sources. You have to do your own research. So can you expand on that and how that participation becomes monetized?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously there's the keeping users on the platform for the purposes of being able to place ads. But then there's kind of an outer rung. So besides just the platform owners and administrators being able to monetize things through ads, there are also people who are kind of more obsessed with doing the Q research. And they are people who are basically already equipped to monetize web content. So influencer type people who are able to garner a following by spending a lot of their time creating almost like higher quality content that distills these Q drops initially. This is kind of like a service for more casual followers of Q and the Q drops who may simply just be spreading this content. You know, not a lot of us are really creating quality content for the internet, but, you know, most people are doing some sort of sharing, transferring this more radical content onto other web platforms like Facebook.
How much weight would you give to that distinction between people who are consumed with this, and it is kind of their jobs, and they're making money off of it or garnering some kind of followers, versus casual friends or followers who have a kind of resonance with its increasing right-wing forms?
I haven't done the platform analytics on this, but my sense is that that inner circle of bakers, they're called, who bake the crumbs that Q drops, is relatively small. And then those casual users who might share or repost something is quite a bit larger. You know, you can see this in other metrics and things that people have studied. For example, the fact that most people polled about specific facets of the Q narrative don't actually know these in detail, mm-hmm. or don't necessarily agree with the finer points. But these are people who, presumably a larger group of people, who sort of just spread this stuff without necessarily reading it in detail or knowing
what it
means.
It's like so many religions. There are the very pious devoted followers, and there are people who go to church on the holidays, you know. So
precisely, and so often, right, there's something really in it for the major devotees, and it's really their responsibility to sort of fan this stuff as far out as possible.
So these crumbs that are baked into some kind of a form crumb cake, I like to call them, you know, the narratives and that cohere and emerge and take hold. Can you just describe some of the central narratives that are, you know, part of what's called conspiracy theories or conspiracy narratives, and whether those have shifted over time as the Republican Party has either directly or indirectly embraced Q followers?
Yeah, so the basic conspiracy theory, and this comes from, this sort of has roots in Pizzagate, the idea that high-level Democrats are running a child sex ring in the basement of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. So fanning out from that, it's sort of the idea that there is, in the political sphere, also, you know, in the media, there is a cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles. They're all liberals, like I said, in the government and in the media, who are running this sex trafficking ring. And QAnon basically exists to position Donald Trump as the messianic figure who is appointed by the military to basically take over the federal government and bring all of these evildoers under control. So there were lots of references to the storm is coming, the storm being the moment when Donald Trump sort of reins everyone in. There are sealed indictments, right, that would come out and bring all these people
so
back under control.
Let's return to that in a few minutes and how to read that narrative as a political symptom of something of dynamics going on in this country. But I'd like to ask you about, maybe as a fellow psychologist, how much weight we would give to the failure of many of the Q prophecies to be fulfilled. You know, I'm reminded of the classic book by Leon Fessinger, When Prophecy Fails, who followed a group of believers who went to a hilltop ready for the world to end, and then it didn't happen. And then he followed the beliefs and made certain predictions, some of which were supported by the research, some of which have been criticized, about why people who have an investment in a belief system continue even in the face of the failure of its prophecies. How do you assess the fact that many of the prophecies, including that Trump was going to win, that he was going to return on March 6th, and of course there's an upcoming prediction that he'll return to office in August. What difference does it make from your reading of the responses of Q followers?
Yeah, so a big part of when prophecy fails is that a major determining factor in whether or not people will eschew the fact that a prophecy did fail is how much that belief system and its affordances really embedded itself in the person's life or identity. And so I think at this point, it's important to think about the fact that internet phenomena typically have a remarkable capacity to fizzle. And this is in very large part because the things that happen online don't always succeed in creating genuine community where relationships are sort of lasting beyond the event, or, you know, they sometimes don't make enough of a connection to people's lives.
Right, and
offline.
That they don't require as much of people. And that's a difference perhaps between the Tea Party movement that emerged after the 2008 financial crisis and had an enormous impact politically around the country in bringing a lot of right-wing Republicans into office. And it was basically similar as its focus on dismantling the federal government, anti-taxation, anti-federal government. You know, the Tea Party had chapters and groups where people met, and it required commitments and face-to-face encounters. So you're saying that they're one aspect of these internet communities is they can be fairly ephemeral and not terribly binding.
Precisely. And this is really where the rubber meets the road in terms of how the internet sort of influences our lives. You know, no matter how much time you're spending in your basement on a particular platform, one might even say that the real work of forging communities online is making that connection to the offline world. And this is simply something that doesn't happen if the only focus of the platform is sort of generating revenue through ads. You know, so Q really, I think, broke through to the extent that it did break through to the offline world. It did so in a way that was deeply attached to Trumpism.
And the storm on the Capitol. So they did have their storm.
Precisely.
And there's some,
yeah.
You know, it entered material reality, but also I think there are different readings of those signs as well, and how organized it was, how much QAnon followers were behind that. But, you know, there also are differences in these right-wing groups that have flourished in Oregon, like the Three Percenters, Oath Keepers, Proud Boys. You know, they have different politics, but they share a kind of anti-federal government ideology that's part of the far right. Do you see that in the stories, the conspiracy stories of QAnon, or how much has the anti-federal government politics taken hold here?
I do think that anti-federal government is a sort of unifying theme. And realistically, you know, the storm on the Capitol was sort of this, as it was an attempted coup, and as there have been comparisons to, for example, the military coup going on in Myanmar right now, I think that the anti-federal government point is the one to emphasize. And so you see Q politicians like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who aren't really interested in getting anything done politically. They kind of just want to be around doing nothing as a sort of effort to dismantle the federal government.
So just in closing, perhaps one response to QAnon would be to get the federal government to do things in the public interest for everyday people. Do you want to say anything about that or other ways we might politically respond other than through our own kind of moral panic about it that can also kind of magnify it? Perhaps there's a risk of magnifying it beyond its actual reach.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree. And I think this is a really important point that, you know, if you have this far-right radicalization so centered on destruction without building anything new, that's a really wonderful messaging opportunity and action avenue for the left, basically, is for the left to be able to reclaim to some degree its sort of creative drive. And this especially pertains to, you know, whether or not there is any hope left in the capacities of the federal government to, you know, govern for the people in public interest in a real way.
Yeah. So I think that's a good point to stop on. that's where we need to organize. Thank you so much, Emmeline Friedman, for being with us today on The Old Mole again, talking about QAnon. And we hope to have you on regularly to talk about internet possibilities and politics.
That sounds wonderful. It's great to be here.